Saviors of the Islamic Spirit by Sheikh Abu al-Hassan Ali Nadwi. Abu Hamid Muhammad al-Ghazali. Imam Ghazali was the rector of the Nizamiya University of Baghdad. This was the most coveted academic position of the time, although Imam Ghazali was not more than 34 years of age when he took over. His renown as a savant, teacher, and an eloquent speaker spread so rapidly that his lectures began to be overcrowded by an ever larger number of students and scholars. Sometimes, in addition to his 300 students, hundreds of nobles, chiefs, attended his lectures. Imam Ghazali soon came to occupy, on account of his scholarship, intelligence, and forceful personality, such a position of eminence in Baghdad that he was regarded as someone who can be compared to the kings and the chiefs of state. In prestige and solemnity, according to the chronicles of the time, Imam Ghazali surpassed the nobility of Baghdad, including even the Khalifa. In 485 AH, the Abbasid Khalifa, Muqtadi Billah, appointed him as the ambassador in the court of Turhan Khatun, who was then the head of the Suljikid Empire. Another Abbasid Khalif, Mustashir Billah, held Imam Ghazali in high esteem, and it was on his behest that he wrote a book to refute the Batinites at the time. He named the book as Al-Mustaziri, after the Khalifa's name. Imam Ghazali's intellectual crisis. During this period of prosperity, worldly fame, and brilliant achievements for which a scholar can aspire, it was only natural that Imam Ghazali should live a life of contentment, as most of the scholars usually did. But for a man of lofty ideals, creative genius, and intellectual grit, as Imam Ghazali was, it was unthinkable that he would rest satisfied merely with position and prestige. There can be no denying to the fact that his intellectual and internal conflict made him a renovator of the faith. However, history can offer but a few such striking examples where one has abandoned a brilliant career, fame, and position for the satisfaction of his soul. Imam Ghazali has himself described the deeper inner struggle which forced him to give up all the worldly possessions, including his teaching vocation, and to search after the truth. Imam Ghazali then quotes, "There were dialecticians who claimed to possess insight and wisdom, the Batinites who insisted on a hidden and true deeper knowledge vouchsafed to them through impeccable imams. There were scholars and philosophers who arrogated themselves as masters of logic and reason, and then there were the mystics who laid claim to the illuminated and favored with beatific visions." I proceeded to explore the ideas, thoughts, and writings of each of these groups, but was not satisfied with any of them. I studied the writings of the reputed dialecticians and authorities on the science, and myself wrote a few books. I reached the conclusion that although this branch of learning fulfilled its objective, it's not sufficient for my purpose, as it argued on the premise put forth by its opponents. The dialecticians had to rely on a number of premises and propositions which they accept in common with the philosophers, or so they are obliged to accept the authority of the Quran or the Sunnah or the consensus. But these could not, as such, avail to one who has no faith in anything except in the necessary principles of reason, as was the case with me. I was just not satisfied with them. In regards to philosophy, I thought it is necessary to make a detailed and critical study of the science before forming my opinion about it. I had little time to spare from my preoccupations of teaching and writing, since I had as many as 300 students who attended my lectures. However, I somehow found some time, and after finishing my entire literature on the subject, within 2 years, I devoted 1 year to thinking on the premises of philosophy. I reached the conclusion that the secular sciences can be divided into 6 branches: mathematics, logic, physics, politics, ethics, and metaphysics. Of these, the first 5 do not deny or affirm religion, or nor is it necessary to reject them for the affirmation of religion. The precepts of physics sometimes do come in conflict with religious doctrines, but there are just a few of them. In this regard, one ought to believe that the natural phenomenon is not self-propelled but dependent on God Almighty. It is true that all those who come across the agility and incisiveness of the intellect of the philosophers in these sciences are generally overawed by them and are led to the conclusion that this would be true of them in every branch of learning. It is, however, not necessary that if someone is good at one branch, that he be good at another science as well. Anyways, when people see the philosophers denying faith, they too walk in their shoes. On the other hand, some brainless exponents of Islam consider it their bounden duty to refute whatever the scholars are saying, and sometimes even go to the extent of denying their researches in the field of physics as well. The harmful effect of this is that those who accept the veracity of the intellect's search for truth and uphold the necessary principles of reason begin to have doubts in Islam itself, and they become skeptics. The only branch of knowledge which comes in conflict with religion is metaphysics, and it is this science that the philosophers have generally been misled. As a matter of fact, the philosophers have themselves not been able to follow satisfactorily in this branch of science the laws of rigorous argumentation that they have evolved for logical reasoning, and that is why there is a wide difference amongst them in this regard. I have therefore arrived at the conclusion that philosophers would not be able to satisfy me, because the intellect cannot by itself cover the entire fields of objects and events, nor unravel all the mysteries. As for the Batinites, I had the opportunity to make a detailed study of their cult for the writing of the book as requested by the Khalifa. I had found that the veracity of their tenets and doctrines ultimately depends on the teachings of an impeccable, illuminated teacher who is called the Imam. But the existence of such a teacher cannot be verified, and in reality is very doubtful. Now, only the mystics remained to be examined, and therefore I turned my attention to these mystics. Mysticism, too, is of 2 kinds, intellectual and intuitional. It was not easy for me to look into the first, and I went through many books that I gathered and whatever knowledge of mysticism that I could get from these books, but I found that the knowledge of essence of reality could be obtained not through the study of mysticism, but through experiencing it, through intuition and ecstasy brought about by the purification of the heart. I had already attained an unflinching faith through the speculative branches of knowledge and religious and secular sciences that I had mastered on the existence of the supreme reality of Allah, the prophethood, and the resurrection. This conviction was, however, not attained through an experience or an argument which could be analyzed. It had been firmly implanted in my heart that the eternal bliss could had only been through inculcating the awe of God in renunciation of the material world. wholeheartedly turning your attention to eternal life in the hereafter, and an earnest devotion to God. All this was, however, not possible as long as I did not break my attachment to positions, riches, fame, and this worldly life. I pondered over my situation and condition. I realized that I was wholly immersed in worldly temptation, its ties, and its attachments. The vocation of teaching appeared to be a noble pursuit, but as further reflection revealed, I was only paying attention to those sciences which are neither important nor beneficial for the hereafter. I probed into the motives of my work as a teacher, and I found that instead of any sincere desire to please God, I was after honor and fame. I was convinced that I was on the edge of hell, and if I did not take immediate steps to improve my situation, that I should be doomed to eternal hellfire. Still undecided, one day, I resolved to abandon everything and leave Baghdad. The next day, I gave up my resolution. 6 months passed away in this state of uncertainty. On one hand, the pull of temptation asked me to remain where I was. On the other, faith gave me a call to get up. It cried to me, "Get up, get up. Your life is short and you have a long journey to make. All your pretended knowledge is not anything but falsehood and fantasy." Often my carnal thoughts whispered to me, quote, "This is temporary. God has favored you with respect and honor. If you give it up and then try to retrace your steps and come back, you will not be able to come back again." Thus, I remained torn by earthly passions and religious aspirations for about 6 months, until it became impossible for me to postpone my decision any longer. Then, God Himself caused me a problem. He chained my tongue and prevented me from lecturing. Vainly I desired to teach my pupils who came to me, but my mouth became dumb. The silence to which I was condemned cast me into a violent despair. I lost all my appetite. I could neither eat a morsel of food nor drink a drop of water. Gradually I became too weak, and at last the physicians under whose treatment I was gave up all hope of my recovery. They said that my heart was severely affected and that no treatment would be of any help for me. Finally, conscious of my weakness and on the prostration of my soul, I took refuge in God like a man who has exhausted himself and is denied any means. I prayed to Him who answers the wronged one when he cries to Him, and He made it easy for me to sacrifice honor, wealth, and family. I intended to go to Syria, but I told people that I would go to Makkah. When the people around me came to know of my decision, they were deeply troubled, for they could not think of any reason behind my resolution. In their opinion, I enjoyed a coveted place which enabled me to preach and spread knowledge. The people also began to spread numerous rumors about me. Those who were far away thought that I was giving up my profession at the INSEE administration. On the other hand, those who knew how much the government was keen on retaining my services considered it a misfortune that I was leaving the best academy of Islamic learning in the world. Finally, I left Baghdad, having given all of my fortune away, preserving only as much was necessary for the support of my family and my children. I went to Syria from Baghdad and I remained there for 2 years. During this period, I engaged in meditation. I practiced whatever I had learned of the ways of the mystics, and I tried to purify my soul, rectify my morals, and I occupied myself with the recollection of God. For a time, I retired to the principal mosque of Damascus, the Umayyad Mosque. Often, I went into one of the minarets of the mosque and remained there in seclusion for days together. From Damascus, I went to Jerusalem. There, too, I visited the grave and tomb of Ibrahim, and I felt a desire to go for Hajj and visit the mosque of the Prophet. I therefore embarked upon my journey to Hijaz, that is the region of Makkah and Medina. After Hajj was over, I went to my hometown. Although I had no longing to visit my family, I took care to spend my time in secluded meditation, purification of the heart, and recollection of God at my house. But the events and happenings and care of dependents and their needs constantly intervened in securing a perfect state of peace. I was therefore not denied of it entirely, but from time to time was favored with illuminations and ecstatic transports. I spent 10 years in this manner. 10 years in this manner. What revelations were made to me during this period of meditation could not be described. But I must say, for the benefits of my readers, that I came to know that the mystics were truly godly. Their life was the most beautiful. Their rules of conduct were most perfect, and their morality was the most beautiful. There were times where, for the sake of undergoing physical exercise, some to emulate others, and the others who considered religious practices necessary for gaining certain material benefits, there were these people who saw no harm in giving up these practices if they could find a way to save themselves from the harm which non-performance of religious observance would have entitled. I realized that I could easily remove their doubts. As a matter of fact, I found myself completely capable of exposing the hollowness and the implausibility of the philosophic conviction because of my deep knowledge of speculative sciences. I therefore, after having seen this spread of the disease of philosophical speculative science, I felt a desire to take up this work, since it appeared to be the crying need of the time. I said to myself, how long does it befit you to sit in seclusion? It is a disease that is spreading like wildfire, and the learned have themselves fell victims to the same disease. The servants of Allah have reached the brink of destruction. But then I also thought whether it was possible for me to accomplish such a huge task. I said to myself, the guidance of the Prophet was available in the days of yesterday, but now, if you look for the men of God and the way of God, the world will be your enemy. How will you, Ghazali, single-handedly struggle against all of them and endure the hardship? This could have been possible under the reign of a pious king determined to assist and promote religion. Thus I expressed my helplessness before God and decided to spend the rest of my life in seclusion. But it seemed that God had willed otherwise. The king asked me to proceed to Nishapur and fight the growing philosophical tendencies. The king had appealed to me so earnestly that my rejection of his order would have certainly made him very angry. Then I said to myself, One of the reasons for your resolve having fallen apart, it cannot be right now to remain in seclusion, for this would simply mean avoiding discomforts and hardships. Has not God said, do men imagine that they will be left in ease because they say that we believe and you will not be tested with affliction? We tested those before you. Thus Allah knows those who are sincere, and Allah knows those who are fake. And Allah addressed His Prophet by, thus although he was the most exalted of His servants, messengers have indeed died before you, and if you died and the persecution till our second reached you, then there is none to alter the decisions of God. Already there has reached you somewhat of the tidings of the messengers that we sent before you. I also sought advice of a few friends who were illuminated and who had beautiful visions. They advised me to take up the seclusion, to give up the seclusion. Few of them related dreams some pious persons had seen, which indicated that the steps I proposed to take would have far-reaching effects for the revival of faith. They hinted that in the 5th century, which was about to begin after a month, something remarkable was to happen which would renovate the faith. This has been foretold in the traditions of the Prophet, that in the beginning of the century, Allah brings forth men who restore and rejuvenate the faith of people. All these tidings gave hope to me, and Allah made it easy for me to go to Nishapur, and I finally made up my mind to renounce my seclusion in 499 AH. I had left Baghdad in 488 AH, and thus I remained in seclusion for 11 years. God had ordained it to happen, thus it happened. I could not have dreamt of giving up honor and faith before I left Baghdad, but God had made it easy for me. Similarly, I could have never thought of renouncing my seclusion and going back to Nishapur and Baghdad again, but God made it easy for me. Imam Ghazali set off for Nishapur in 499 AH to resume his teaching at the Nizamiya University. There was, however, a world of difference between his taking up the teaching profession earlier and this time. Earlier, he thought to secure honor, wealth, and position, but now he considered himself commissioned to exhort people to purify their morals and soul. He explains the difference in his own words. Quote, I know that I have come back to my vocation of teaching, but it would not be correct to call it a resumption of my earlier occupation. There is a world of difference between these two. Earlier, I used to teach the sciences which were calculated to bring honor, wealth, position, and by my words and actions, I led my students in that direction. But now I want to teach them the knowledge that helps them renounce wealth and position. God is fully aware that my intention and my only desire is that my present efforts should lead to the purification of my soul and the souls of other people. I don't know whether I would reach my destination or would pass away before completion of my task. However, I believe that I have an unflinching conviction on account of the knowledge of certitude which has been revealed upon me, that the real power rests in God alone. It is only God who can save one from evil and can lead him to a path of beauty and grace. I did not come here on my own accord. It was God who moved me to this place. I did not begin my work, but God made me begin it. I ask Allah that He may first cleanse and elevate my soul before He causes me to reform and purify the souls of others. May Allah reveal unto me righteousness which I may follow and disclose the evils which I may forsake. The achievements of Imam Ghazali. Endeavors of Imam Ghazali for the revival of Islam were of twofold. First, he stemmed the tide of philosophy and of the Batinites' evil and began a counterattack on these movements on behalf of Islam. He made a critical evaluation of the religious and moral state of the Islamic society, and he proposed measures to reform it. Imam Ghazali's encounter with philosophy. The efforts made till the time of Imam Ghazali to counteract the atheistic influence of Greek philosophy consisted merely of an apologetic vindication of Islamic tenets. Philosophers were then taking the offensive, and the scholars of Islam were content with parrying the attack, that is, deflecting the attack. Philosophy was undermining the very foundations of Islam, while the scholars tried to shield it, but none amongst the scholars or the doctors of the religion had the courage to strike at the roots of philosophy. In fact, no savant of Islam had tried to make any critical evaluation of the philosophical premises and to completely destroy the aggressor in his own backyard. The tone of the scholars, save only that of Abul Hasan al-Ash'ari, who did not have, however, to face the philosophers, was apologetic and at best defensive. Al-Ghazali was the first man who, along with his profound knowledge of religious sciences, made a detailed and a deep study of philosophy as well, and wrote a book called The Aim of the Philosophers, in which he summed up the issues of logic, metaphysics, and physics. In this book, he condensed the philosophical premises disproportionately and dispassionately in an explicit manner. He made it clear in the introduction of the book that mathematics is a science which does not admit any difference of opinion, but it has nothing to do with religion, either to affirm or negate religion. Religion, however, comes into conflict with metaphysics. The logical arguments were sometimes wrong, while there may also be differences of opinion in regards to terminology employed in this branch of learning. Imam Ghazali then wrote a book called Incoherence of the Philosophers. In this book, he criticizes, from an Islamic point of view, physics and metaphysics of the philosophical school and brings out their weaknesses and contradictions in a forceful language. We find Al-Ghazali expressing himself self-confidently in an elegant manner. At places, he employs a satirical diction, which was not only effective, but perhaps necessary to bring back the self-confidence of those who were overawed by philosophy. We find the author self-reliant, attempting to demolish the reputation of the teachers of philosophy. He speaks of the Greek philosophers and guides as his equals and points out their mistakes in a manner none had dared to before him. In order to save the situation for Islam, it was imperative that someone should be able to strike at the foundations of philosophy instead of merely defending the faith. Imam Ghazali rose to the occasion, and this book speaks of his endeavors from cover to cover. In the introduction, Imam Ghazali writes, "Nowadays we see people who appear to be arrogant as intellectually superior to the population. These people look disdainingly on religious practices, for they have learned the awe-inspiring names of some Greek philosophers like Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato. They have learned from these writings of these admirers that the Greek doctors of the old had made far-reaching discoveries in the fields of mathematics, logic, physics, and metaphysics, and that these teachers, Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates, were peerless in qualities of the heart and heart, but they had rejected the faith and its doctrines. The Greek masters regarded religion as a man-made dogma without any content of truth. Now, following in the steps of their mentors, these elements and these people too have rejected religions so that they may be taken as intelligent, liberal, and a smart set of people. Simply to feign themselves as intellectuals and elites, these people denigrate religion, and this is why I thought of bringing out in light the mistakes committed by the Greek philosophers in their writings on metaphysics. I also intend to demonstrate how the premises and principles, notions and observations of these philosophers are nothing but child's play, and they are indeed a laughingstock. After giving a detailed description of the genealogy and horoscope of the Greek philosophic cum metaphysical concepts like logos, naos, the first clause, or the intermediate agents between the primal cause and his creation, Imam Ghazali becomes more trenchant and lively in his criticism of the philosophers. He writes, "Your doctrines and details thereof are simply assumptions, or, to be truthful, obscure reflections overcast with darkness. Nobody would doubt the insanity of a man who even dreams of such nonsensical things. I really wonder how even a brainless person can swallow such inconsistencies, much less philosophers who are inclined to hair-splitting in logical disputation. In venerating the agent intellect, these people have completely overlooked to accord the reverence and awe that is due to God. They have made God an ineffective deity, a simple essence dealing with the universals and having no knowledge of the details. He bears the distinction from a lifeless entity only in so far as he possesses his own consciousness. And who knows that the lifeless objects are devoid of all consciousness? Verily, God misguides those who forsake the path of divine guidance and deny his revelations. As it is said in the Quran, I have made them not to witnesses the creation of the heavens and the earth, nor their own creation. Those who have misgivings about the omnipotence of God Almighty think that divine beings can be subjected to their thoughts and their imaginations. Being presumptuous of their intellect, they hold that it is not necessary to follow the prophets of God. That these persons should propagate under the cover of philosophy such ludicrous presumptions, which others would be ashamed to dream of, is indeed natural and reasonable." Effect of the book, Incoherence of the Philosophers. The courageous criticism and, to an extent, the denigration of philosophy by Imam Ghazali began a new chapter in the history of Islamic scholasticism, which was later brought to a successful completion by Sheikh Ibn Taymiyyah. Incoherence of the Philosopher caused a stir in the ranks of philosophers who had to suffer an irreparable loss on account of the book. However, after Imam Ghazali, there arose no philosopher worthy of note for 100 years. At last, Ibn Rushd, a great admirer of Aristotle and a spiritual defender of philosophy, wrote another book called Incoherence of Incoherence by way of denouncing the book by the close of the 6th century, denouncing the book of Imam Ghazali. Many scholars are of the view that Ibn Rushd had not put up a defense on behalf of philosophy, it would have been crippled by the hostile criticism of Imam Ghazali. Philosophy was granted a fresh lease of life through the efforts of Ibn Rushd for another 100 years. Attack on the Ba'athinites. Besides philosophy, the crisis caused by the Ba'athinites movement had received attention of Imam Ghazali during his first stay of Baghdad. Imam Ghazali has made a mention of this book in his autobiographical account, the one that he wrote at the request of the Khalifa, the one that denigrates the Ba'athinites. Imam Ghazali perhaps wrote three other books to do the same. Two more books on the subject of Ba'athinites have also been mentioned in the list of Imam Ghazali's writings. No one else could have encountered the Ba'athinites so successfully as Imam Ghazali did, for he was fully aware of the ways of the mystics, besides being a savant of both secular and religious sciences. Taking shelter behind the terminology drawn from philosophy and their cult of esoteric meanings, which was a combination of sophisticism and conspiracy, for a man like Imam Ghazali, it was comparatively easy to smash the Ba'athinites. His effective answer to the challenge of Ba'athinites made a discredited sect forever after him. Imam Ghazali's evaluation of social conditions. The second remarkable achievement of Imam Ghazali was his evaluation of social and moral state of society from an Islamic point of view, which awakened the spirit to revive Islam in the community. His trademark book, The Revival of Religious Sciences, Ihya Ulumuddin, was a result of his endeavors in this regard. The book, Ihya Ulumuddin. Ihya Ulumuddin occupies a distinguished place amongst the few literary works which have had a lasting effect in molding the moral and spiritual life of the Islamic world. Hafiz Zain Uddin al-Iraqi, who brought out a collection of the traditions quoted in the Ihya, is of the opinion that it is the foremost literary composition of any Islamic person. Abdul Ghafir Farsi, a contemporary of Imam Ghazali and a disciple of Imam al-Haramain, says that no book like it has ever been written before. Another reputed scholar, Sheikh Muhammad Ghazruni, remarked that if all the books of Islam were removed except for the Quran and they were completely wiped off, the tradition of the Prophet and the tradition of Islam can be revived itself with the help of Ihya. Hafiz Ibn al-Jawzay differed from Imam Ghazali on many issues, but he acknowledges the popularity and the matchless sincerity of the Ihya and has written a summary of it under the caption Minhaj al-Qasidin. The Ihya was written at a time when Imam Ghazali had returned home after more than 10 years in seclusion and meditation in search of the truth. He now wanted to disseminate his message of reform amongst the people. In reflecting the tremendous sincerity and heroic sacrifice, heartfelt certitude, and the ardent zeal of Imam Ghazali to revive the true faith of Islam in the Ihya, it represents a beautiful example. Shibli Naomi writes in Al-Ghazali, his book, "In Baghdad, Imam Ghazali felt an irresistible urge to embark upon the quest of truth. He proceeded to study each religion, but he still remained dissatisfied. At last, he turned to mysticism, but it was something to be experienced in the recesses of one's heart rather than to be studied, and the first step towards that was the purification of the heart and transformation of the self." The preoccupations of Imam Ghazali, however, left no time for him. What honor and fame, sermons and debates had to do with the purification of the heart and the soul? Obviously, it was a path that led to waywardness. At last, Donning a mendicant's habit, he left Baghdad and he took to wandering. After a long period spent alternately in complete seclusion and meditation, he had an access to divine manifestation. He would have spent the rest of his life lost in beautiful visions, but witnessing the contamination of the religion and morals around him, a malady from which even the elite as well as the illiterate were suffering alike, he began to give expression to his experiences and convictions. He could not bear with equanimity the denigration of the mentors of faith into the cesspool of crass materialism. He wrote the book in these circumstances. He himself writes in his preface, "I found everyone hankering after material gains. People had become forgetful of the hereafter, while the doctors of the religion, the scholars who were the guides to the right path, could no longer be found. There remained only those who had lost their soul to worldly temptations. These people had led everyone to suppose that knowledge consists simply in debates and arguments by which they spread their fame, or else ornate sermons by which they held the people spellbound, or else legal opinion by which they sat in judgment to settle the dispute of others. The knowledge that was required to illuminate the path leading to the world to come thus had completely disappeared. I could not endure this state of affairs, and I had to ultimately sound the alarm for the world." Imam Ghazali's critique of the society. Imam Ghazali's object was to bring out moral and spiritual transformation of the people of his time. He wanted to create, for the purpose of awareness of the ills and weaknesses of the Muslims as well as their religious and intellectual leaders were suffering from, he wanted to tell them how the devil of earthly possessions had taken hold of the different sections of society, and to let them realize what factors were responsible for diverting their attention from the true content of faith to its outer forms, its rituals, its customs, thus making these people oblivious to eternal life and the hereafter and the will and pleasure of God. In order, therefore, to achieve the end, he had, in this view, Imam Ghazali undertook a detailed analysis of intellectual and moral approach of the then society towards life and world. He highlighted the vices of different sections. He defined the aims and the methods necessary to achieve these objectives. He de-alienated the individuals and communal obligations of the people. He brought out distinguishing features and differences between secular and religious sciences. He invited attention of the affluent and the ruling class towards their mistakes. He criticized unjust laws and rules which were spread by the state. He exhorted them to give up their un-Islamic ways, customs, and traditions. It was thus the first detailed sociological study in Islam which brought out courageously the social and moral ills of the society and suggested measures for its reformation and transformation into a healthy community. Imam Ghazali held the religious doctors, the ulama, responsible for all around religious and moral denigration of the Muslim people. To him, religious doctors were the salt of the earth. If they went astray, nothing could keep the people on the right path. An Arab poet has expressed the same idea in these words. O teachers of faith, you are the salt of the earth. If the salt gets contaminated, what is there to purify the earth again? Complaining that the prevailing widespread vices were accountable to the negligence of the religious teachers, Imam Ghazali writes, the third person, which really constitutes an incurable disease, is that the patients, they are, but no physicians are available to treat the patients. The ulama are the physicians, but these days they themselves are sick and bedridden and unable to cure others, let alone themselves. The same reason has been attributed by Imam Ghazali for the waywardness of the rulers and the kings. He writes, "In short, the debasement of the people is a result of the corruption of the rulers, who get perverted on account of demoralization of the scholars of religion. Had there been no self-seeking religious scholars, the rulers would not have been so depraved, for in that case they would have been mindful of the warnings of the scholars." The neglect of the rulers, of the ulama, to enjoin the right and forbid the wrong, as the savants of the old used to do, was severely criticized by Imam Ghazali. He deplored the timidness of religious teachers of his time, who were not courageous enough to uphold what was right in the face of the king, because they had been inflicted by the love of wealth, power, and honor. After citing numerous instances where ulama had fearlessly stood against the injustice of powerful kings and tyrannical rulers, Imam Ghazali says in the Ihya, "This is how the learned enjoined right and forbade the wrong. They did not care at all for the glory of the kings, for they used to put their trust in God alone, and they were confident that God would protect them. They were ever willing to lay down their lives for the sake of God and for the sake of their religion, if God had desired. Whatever they say was taken to heart, for their intentions were pure. Their immaculate sincerity molded even the hard-hearted king. But now, the earthly temptations have made them dumb. Even if they speak out, it has no effect because they lack sincerity. They can be effective even now if they cultivate selflessness, detachment, and love of the religion. People have become depraved because of their rulers, and the rulers have become depraved because of the religious teachers, the ulama, who have been demoralized on account of their love of wealth and power and honor. One who has been affected by worldly temptations cannot admonish even the lowly and the poor, much less the elites and the kings." One of the religious teachers of the time, Imam Ghazali pointed out, has given themselves up to hair splitting on juristic issues and imaginary problems in social gatherings and religious meetings, royal courts, and scholarly seminars on juristic nature had come to be regarded as inevitable intellectual diversion. It had become such a rage in those times that, in their craze to arm themselves for a knockout victory in debates, the scholars were neglecting all other branches of learning, including even the religious sciences, the knowledge that is basic necessity for spiritual and moral rectitude, for the preparation of life in the hereafter. Imam Ghazali protests against this state of affairs in the Ihya in the following words: "If any scholar is asked about the virtues and vices like patience, thankfulness, fear and awe of God, envy, hypocrisy, deception, contentment, or how to avoid hankering after the praise and respect by others, he would not be able to give you any answer. Although he ought to know these as a preparation for life in the world to come. On the other hand, if you ask him about the smallest detail, He will give you a detailed description of each and every aspect, although one will seldom come across these issues. And if anybody needs a juristic opinion on these matters, he can easily obtain it in every town of the empire. These scholars thus devote their entire time and energy in learning and teaching the details of insignificant issues, but remain oblivious to the knowledge essential for a religious scholar. If these scholars were ever asked about it, their reply is that they are engaged in acquiring a religious knowledge which helps them in Sharia. They are really keeping themselves in the dark and they are deceiving other people. For as everybody knows, he who wants to acquit himself of a communal obligation should first discharge the obligations which are enjoined upon him as a person. Also, there are many other communal obligations which claim a preference, as for example, we have many non-Muslim physicians in the city whose evidence is not acceptable under the Sharia in religious matters requiring a medical opinion. But we do not find any scholar turning to the study of medicine. Students overcrowd the classroom of the sciences pertaining to jurisprudence, logic, and dialectics, although there are hundreds of juristic consultants which are ever willing to give their legal opinions. I fail to understand how these scholars can defend their engagement in communal obligation, which is being already performed by many, many, many people, while disregarding another obligation which is not being attended to by anyone. If there are any reasons for it, except that the study of medicine cannot help them secure the trusteeship of very large charitable trusts, the enforcement of the wills, the guardianship of the orphans, and the management of their property, appointment to the posts of judges, respect and honor in government circles, or precedence over their compatriots, friends, and foes. And another place in the Ihya, Imam Ghazali writes, "There is not a town in which several matters do not assume the position of joint or communal obligations, but there is none to look after these, nor any scholar pays any attention to them. Take, for instance, the study of medicine. There are a number of towns in which there is no practicing physician whose evidence is acceptable in law, but the scholars lack all interest in this profession. Similar is the case with the obligation incumbent on all Muslims to enjoin the right and forbid the wrong. This is being overlooked by everybody." Imam Ghazali laments the general lack of interest in and the apathy of the people towards the tenets of the faith, and calls attention towards the need of spreading literacy and disseminating the knowledge of religion. After emphasizing the paramount need for spreading religious knowledge, he continues to say, quote, "For anyone who is solicitous of his religion, the teachings and spreading of the knowledge and knowledge of the faith, which is also a joint obligation, is such a serious occupation that it would not permit him to go into any unnecessary details of jurisprudence and waste his time in any scholarly hair splitting or any such trivial activities." Unquote. Imam Ghazali explained why the wrangling over disputed issues had come to assume such an important position among the scholars of the time, who in due course had begun to devote their time and energy to such fruitless fights. Tracing the history of these vain disputations, Imam Ghazali writes, quote, "The caliphs succeeding the prophets of Islam were themselves scholars. They were competent to give legal opinions in all matters, and they seldom required the help of other companions of the Prophet in this task. The learned among the companions therefore occupied themselves with the studies leading to the salvation in the world to come. If they were ever asked of any legal opinion, they would refer the question to another companion of the prophet, and they would remain absorbed in the recollection of God. Numerous instances of this kind have been preserved by the historians. Thereafter, undeserving and incompetent people came to preside over the Islamic empire. They were also incompetent to give legal opinions or to settle the disputes of people, and therefore they had the necessity to depend on the scholars in the administration of justice. The scholars among the descendants of the companion generally followed in the footsteps of the scholars of old. They were aware of the true content of faith. They were selfless and detached people, and hence they avoided the company of the rulers and the kings. The Umayyad and the Abbasid caliphs had to look around for them, and they had to implore them to accept the offices of jurists and judges. The masses of the time, who witnessed the solicitation of the kings and the indifference of the devout scholars, thought that the study of juristic sciences was the easiest way to acquire the riches and honor, as well as gain access into the entourage of the king. These people, therefore, themselves applied for government offices and maneuvered to win the favors of the rulers and the administrators in the hope of achieving worldly success. Some of them gained their end while others licked the dust, but even those who did succeed had to humble themselves by applying for these offices. They had to come down from the exalted place of scholars to that of servants. Another result of it was that the scholars who were earlier implored to accept these offices began to offer themselves as candidates for these offices. Earlier they were honored for their selfless detachment from the ruling circles, but now they have lost their respect by becoming henchmen of the king and servants of the rulers. A few scholars were, however, an exception to this in every age. The analogical deduction drawn up on legal and theological questions in accordance with the principles of jurisprudence and the teachings of Sharia were needed primarily to meet the requirements of administration during the earlier times. In due course, however, the nobles and the scholar and the kings too cultivated an interest in these matters. They began to encourage the scholars to discuss these issues. In view of the interest taken by the king in these discussions, people began to devote themselves to the study of dialectics. Numerous books came to be written on the sciences of debates. Rules were evolved for these debates, and gradually the wranglings were turned into an art of logical science. These persons tried to justify their endeavors on the ground that the aim was to protect the scriptures of the religion and the sunnah of the prophet and to oppose innovations in the religion. Those who were earlier engaged in giving legal opinions had also made a similar claim that they intended to serve the faith and the people by helping them to settle the disputes. A few rulers and administrators of the latter times undoubtedly looked upon the dialectics and the disputations with disfavor, for they thought that these gave rise to academic orthodoxy and disputes, and not unoften even to violent strife and bloodshed. On the other hand, there were kings and chiefs desirous to find out which of the two schools of Islamic jurisprudence, the Hanafis or the Shafis, was closer to the right path. These people encouraged discussions and debates on juristic issues. The scholars belonging to their entourage accordingly put aside all other issues and took to the controversies between the Hanafis and the Shafis, overlooking the difference of opinion between other jurists like Imam Malik and Imam Ahmad bin Hanbal. Similarly, simply because their masters were not interested in the differences between these two schools rather than those two schools. Laying a claim to the refinement and amplification of Islamic law and to the formation of principles, these scholars compiled innumerable books on the subject. They cultivated logical sciences and developed it into many books. They are still preoccupied with this vocation, and only God knows to what extent they will go. Thus, the reason for undue interest taken by the scholars in these controversies and the contentious reasoning is that we have stated above. If the nobility or the powers that were to take interest in juristical differences of the schools rather than those of Abu Hanifa and Shafi, these people would immediately start fighting over the questions relating to these schools. And they would still claim that their aim is simply to acquire knowledge and to seek the pleasure of God. After tracing the origins of contentious debates, Imam Ghazali set forth in some detail the ill effects springing from these arguments. He also describes his own experience since he had himself earlier taken a keen interest in such arguments. The vocabulary employed to denote the new science then cultivated was also creating a misunderstanding. Words or phrases occurring in the Quran, the traditions of the Prophet, or the sayings of the Prophet, or even the words of the Sahaba were being widely used for new sciences being evolved in those times. To give a few examples, the word fiqh was being commonly used for intricate and hypothetical details of legal questions, as well as for differences in legal opinions in regards to such issues. The word ilm, which means knowledge, was a common term employed to describe all sorts of learning, religious or even secular. The scholarly or logical arguments, as was known as tawhid, the unity of God, Tazkir, the recollection or the act of devotion to God, was the name assigned to all sorts of lectures replete with fantastic tales, while hikmah denoted uncommon practices. With their indiscriminate use of peculiar sense conveyed by these terms in the context of the Quran or the Sunnah had come to be associated with new sciences as well. Thus the Quranic verse that says, so that they may understand religion and the tradition that God grants understanding of the religion to those who intend to be virtuous, were applied to the unforeseeable legal fighting, the divine tidings that those granted wisdom and religion have been bestowed a great favor was appropriated to philosophy and scholarism of the 5th century. The verse of the Quran, remember God, for you may be one of the devoted, was employed for the wild sermons of the ignorant and misguided preachers. Imam Ghazali explained how these words were being used out of context to mean something which these terms were never intended to convey. He traced the original meaning of these words and phrases, which had been lost owing to their misuse, but which also were widely used from the sense conveyed during those times. The analysis made by Imam Ghazali was as much instructive as it was helpful in removing the misconceived notions created by the careless and indiscriminate use of religious terminology, which was being employed as a vehicle for the furtherance of new sciences. Imam Ghazali's critique of the rulers and the kings. Imam Ghazali held that along with religious teachers, the kings, the rulers, the administrators, the nobles were also responsible for widespread moral and spiritual denigration of the people. Abdullah ibn Mubarak had also expressed the same feeling in regards to the kings and the nobles 200 years before Imam Ghazali in his famous saying that says, "And who pollutes religion except the kings, the nobles, and the ulama?" Unmindful of his personal safety, Imam Ghazali stood up against the unjust ways of the powerful kings and autocratic rulers who had considered themselves above every law. It was a common practice amongst the scholars in those days to accept donations or stipends granted by the kings. Imam Ghazali was, however, courageous enough to denounce these awards as unlawful. He declared that these grants were at best doubtful and at worst haram, which is prohibited. He writes, "The revenues accruing to the kings these days are mostly prohibited, for they seldom have a lawful income, or they have, if any, it is very small." Again, he says, "The income of the kings in our times is either entirely haram, or it's a major portion that comes under this category. There is nothing surprising in it, because we find nowadays no trace of the lawful sources like zakat or ghanima, which is the spoils of war. No income from these sources generally reaches the king. Among the lawful sources, only the poll tax, which is jizya, remains now, but the numerous unjust means are employed in the recovery of this money from the non-Muslims, which are not allowed by the Sharia. The officials of the state exceed the limits both in regard to the amount to be recovered from non-Muslim people and the person to be assessed for the poll tax. The conditions laid down for the assessment of this tax are also disregarded. Apart from these sources of income, the coffers of the state are also filled with the riches extracted from the Muslims far in excess of the tributes of the land held by them. Confiscations, illegal gratifications, and similar other taxes which are collected even more mercilessly than the poll tax from the non-Muslims." Imam Ghazali maintained that since the riches amassed by the kings was either completely unlawful or at least doubtful from the point of view of Sharia, it was advisable that no grants or donations out of it should be accepted by a scholar. Such an income, he held, was not conducive to the spiritual advancement of the recipient. He further argued that instances of scholars accepting royal grants in the past could undoubtedly be cited, but that was a world altogether different from his own time. In this connection, he writes, "The despotic rulers of the past, because of being nearer to the time of the rightly guided caliphs, were at least conscious of their tyrannical ways, and hence they were eager to win the favor of the companions of the Prophet or his associates and descendants. Since these rulers of the old were anxious that their favor should be accepted by the devout scholars, they made these presentations of their own accord without any strings attached to their donations. They even expressed gratitude for the acceptance of these grants by the scholars. The religious savants, on the other hand, accepted these presentations only to be distributed amongst the poor and the needy. At the same time, these mentors of the old never sided with the rulers in the furtherance of their political ends. They never paid visits to the kings or the administrators, nor did they ever encourage the kings or the administrators to call them. It was not unoften that they warned the kings of their irreligious behavior and even cursed them for their tyrannical ways. Thus, these scholars accepted the presentations of the then rulers because there was no danger of any harmful effect on the faith of the scholar because of it. The kings nowadays have, however, only such scholars on their payrolls whom they hope to win over to their side for certain ulterior motives, or those who would be willing to act as their entourages and sing their praises. The vices flowing out of the acceptance of such favors are many. First, the scholar has to endure humiliation. Second, he has to pay visits to the king. Third, he has to be lavish in his praise of the king. Fourth, he is required to help the king in realizing his ends. Fifth, he has to dance attendance on the ruler like other courtiers. Sixth, he also has to express gratitude and assure the king of his help. And seventh, he has to hold his tongue over the tyrannies and misdeeds of the king. The rulers nowadays would not extend their help to anybody who is not willing to accept any of these conditions, no matter whether he is a great scholar of Shafi or Hanafi fame. It is because of these reasons that it is unlawful now for anyone to accept donations from the king, even if one knows that the latter have derived their income through lawful means. Thus, there is absolutely no justification for accepting grants out of the revenue which has been mobilized through prohibited means. Now, if anybody still unashamedly accepts the donations from these kings and quotes the companions of the prophets and their successors as precedent, he perhaps considers the angels to be peers of blacksmiths, for he cannot avoid waiting upon the king or even their chiefs and officials and playing certain fiddle to them. All of these are sins. I have now explained the sources of lawful and unlawful income that comes to the king. If, however, anybody still deems it to be practical to obtain a grant drawn out of the lawful revenues, and he also deserves the same, or he gets it without in any way asking for the same or having to please the king, or else the donation does not depend on any service to be rendered in return of the donation, then it may be lawful to accept the same, but I would still advise that it is preferable to refuse it only on account of the evils likely to follow because of the acceptance of the donation. Imam Ghazali did not merely advise to forsake the donations of the kings. He went further to stress that one ought to completely disassociate oneself with them and hate their tyrannical ways. He writes in the Ihya, "One should be so completely cut off from the kings that he may never come across them. It is obligatory, and indeed safety lies in it, that one should hate them for their injustice to the people. He should never entreat God's blessings for them, or praise them, or else seek acquaintance of their courtiers. One should not even desire to know anything about the king or the administrators. We, as a people, are now living in a democratic age when freedom of speech and expression is more or less assured in almost every country of the world." It is rather difficult to visualize the amount of courage that Imam Ghazali has had to muster and the grave danger that he exposed himself to by openly preaching disassociation with the kings or advising refusal of the grants or criticizing them for their injustice and un-Islamic policies in the social, political or fiscal matters. For the despotic and autocratic rulers, as the kings generally were in those days, even the slightest criticism of the state or its policies or officials was a sufficient mark of treason, and the heads of eminent scholars had rolled on the ground at the slightest displeasures of these tyrants. However, throwing all considerations of personal safety to the wind, Imam Ghazali preached and practiced what he considered to be right, and never faltered from the duty of severely admonishing the arrogant kings of his time. Sultan Sanjar, the son of Seljuk King Malik Shah, was the governor of Khorasan. Once Imam Ghazali happened to see him in his court. Addressing Sanjar, he said before his courtiers, "Indeed regrettable that the necks of the Muslims are breaking under the crushing burden of your tyranny, while those of your horses are overburdened with expensive harnesses." Muhammad, the elder brother of Sanjar, succeeded his father Malik Shah. Imam Ghazali wrote a detailed letter in the form of a book exhorting him to inculcate the awe of God, fulfill his obligation as a king, and work for the betterment of the people. Administration was generally in the hands of ministers in the times of Imam Ghazali. He therefore paid more attention to them than to the kings for bringing about reforms in administration. He wrote detailed letters and directives inviting their attention to the mismanagement, inefficiency, illegal rules and laws, the high-handedness of state officials. Imam Ghazali reminded them of their responsibility before God and invited their attention towards the fate earlier tyrannical rulers and administrators had met. As a consequence of their oppressive administrative policies, the letters written by Imam Ghazali to the ministers of the Seljukid kings mirror his personal courage and the desire for the exposition of truth and effectiveness of his mode of expression. In one of his letters to the minister, Fakhr al-Mulk, Imam Ghazali writes, "You should know that this city has been laid waste by famine and tyranny. Everyone was scared by the news of your presence in the nearby towns. Cultivators sold their produce and hooligans behaved nicely with the population. Now that you are far away, the fear has been taken away from these people. The bully has again taken heart and the farmers and grocers are indulging in black marketing. Anybody sending you a report contrary to what I have stated is not your well-wisher. Verily, the solemn invocation of the oppressed in this city would surely be answered by God. I counseled the governor of this city, but he did not pay any heed to me until an example was made out of him by divine justice. My solemn admonition would undoubtedly appear distasteful to you, but I would not have dared to write this letter if I had not cast away all temptations of the world out of my heart. Pay heed to me, for you would be counseled not like this by anyone after me. Only those who admonish you, who do not allow you their selfishness to conceal the truth." In a letter to another minister, Imam Ghazali writes, "Now that tyranny has reached its limits, it has become incumbent upon you to succor the oppressed. I was a witness of this state of affairs for a year or so. I then migrated to Tus in order to avoid casting a glance over these oppressors. Now I have returned to Tus. I find that the oppression is still continuing." After inviting the attention of the minister to the fate met by earlier minister, Imam Ghazali continues, "The ministers before you met a fate which none had met before them. But now I see the oppression and destruction which I had never witnessed earlier. You may not be pleased with this state of affairs, but when the oppressors will be called on the day of judgment, everyone responsible for his tyranny, even the remotest possible way, will be asked to render an explanation for it. The Muslims of this place are extremely aggrieved. The officials have collected quite a substantial amount from the population, many times more than the money spent by you for distribution amongst the poor, but it has not been remitted to the king. These people are misappropriated the entire amount." We'll continue in part 2.